Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 25th, 1999. In the Koinonia fireside this morning is Leroy Eisminger, and his session number is 99-3. It is entitled The Death Penalty Discussion. Let's listen in.
I welcome you to this class on discussing the issue of the death penalty. I'm Pastor Leroy Eisminger. I am pastor of a unique congregation. It's inside the South Dakota State Penitentiary, where we now have three men on death row. And I'm grateful today that you are here to be a part of this discussion. This half of the circle, those packets, I'll go over these just a little bit. In here, in the pile there, is a capital punishment fact sheet. You can help yourselves to those, pass them around if you want to. Appreciate that. In addition to that, there is this, what we call the Declaration of Life, which is a legal document that you will sign and give to your attorney, which says something like this: I request that should I die under the circumstances of a violent death, I request that the person or persons found guilty of my homicide not be subject to or put in jeopardy of the death penalty under any circumstance, no matter how heinous their crime or how much I may have suffered. The death penalty would only increase my suffering. And there are other statements there. You look at it, take it home if you like to put that along with your will. In addition to there are several of these pamphlets put out by Walter Wangren, who is the speaker on Lutheran Vespers. He tells me that this is the pamphlet, the sermon that he preached on Lutheran Vespers that has been most requested. It's regarding capital punishment. And then you have, in addition to that, I only had 10 copies of this book, Capital Punishment Discussion Resource Packet. I especially find the article inside here tremendously helpful. It says it's easy to believe in the death penalty if you ignore the facts. That's available for you. Then, if any of you would like to see additional videos about the death penalty, I have the death of Carla Faye Tucker. She was this woman who was recently executed in Texas, and it shows the tremendous difference in her life. She was not the same Carla Faye Tucker who committed the crime. And then I also have the CBS video on Rolando Cruz, whose death penalty was really probably what got one certain politician into office, because his politician said, if I'm elected, I'll see to it that he is killed. Then you also have a green sheet there, which is entitled Death Penalty Information Resources, Audiovisual, Print, and then also cassette tapes. The way we're going to be doing it today is I'm going to be giving a few comments on the death penalty, my position. I will tell you up front, I am 100% against it, and I'll tell you why, and I'll include my church's, the Evangelical Lutheran Church's, position on the death penalty. I ordered 50 copies of this, and guess what? I ran off from South Dakota and left them in my office. And I discovered that after I got here. But I sent word back with somebody that I happened to know, meet here. He was going to call my secretary, and I hope that they come in case, and we can put them in the bookstore. The two books in the bookstore that are available are Dead Men Walking by Sister Helen Prejean. Some of you saw the movie last evening, and this Against the Death Penalty. That is also available in the bookstore. The Lutheran article, which is not just another protester, is an article written by a man whose family member was killed, and he's pleading to spare the man's life. He doesn't feel that that would help the situation. And so what we're going to be doing this morning, I'm going to be giving this presentation. It's going to be somewhat brief, and then we will go into a discussion. Some of you saw Dead Man Walking last evening, and then the session will close with a video entitled Journey of Hope. I'm grateful that I can be here to personally speak out against the death penalty. I know, though, that there are other people within my ELCA who have different points of view. I quote from this article here put out by the ELCA, while the Holy Spirit makes us one in our faith, we can and do vary in our responses to the gospel. Then I go on to quote, the Evangelical Lutheran Church has not finished its deliberation on the issue of the death penalty. We continue the deliberation and the discussion upholding together the authority of Scripture, creeds, and the confessions. We insist on the value of God-given life and the commitment to serve God's justice. As a church, we are united in our resistance to hatred and our commitment to love our enemies as our Lord asks us to do, and at the supreme cost to himself showed us the breadth of what that can mean. As a church, we are committed to following our Lord's example, even though we have to do that in an often vengeful society. As a church, heeding the call to do justice, we minister to a broken society, and because we are united for mission, we are committed to ministries of restoration and healing. Because we are a church intent on following Jesus, we are committed to restorative justice rather than punitive or retributive justice. And then it goes on to say, this commitment means addressing the hurt of each person whose life has been hurt by violent crime. And it is because our church's ministry with and to people affected by violent crime that we, the ELCA, oppose the death penalty. Executions focus on the convicted murderer, providing very little for the victim's family or anyone else whose life has been touched by the crime. Capital punishment focuses on retribution and sometimes reflects a spirit of vengeance. Executions do not restore broken society, and we believe they can actually work counter to restoration. I'm going to just pause here for a moment. In one of our local papers, there's Mike McManus. He's writing, wrote an article entitled Death Penalty Helps Provide More Violence. The article goes on. Our church recognizes the need to protect society from people who are a danger to that society, and we support the need to remove offenders from society and placing them in a secure facility and denying them the possibility of committing further crime. Our challenge is to incapacitate offenders in a manner that limits violence and holds open the possibility of conversion and restoration. Our church urges the abolition of the death penalty and supports alternative and appropriate punishment for capital crime, including the possibility of life sentences without parole. End of what I'll be quoting from the ELCA document. Now, many supporters of the death penalty cite the Old Testament to justify their position. And one can find vengeance as a theme in the Old Testament, and the Old Testament does allow the death penalty. I want to quote something here. I thought I had it right here. It's from the discussion guide for Sister Helen's movie, Dead Man Walking, where she has interviewed some rabbis. It says here, the rabbis made such punishment, the death penalty, nearly impossible through biblical interpretation and Talmudic law. Laws regarding evidence and eyewitnesses' testimony were so strict as to impose a standard of proof almost impossible to meet. That was what they were saying for the Old Testament. I personally believe that Christ came to institute a new order, and it is my conviction that the Old Testament must always be subordinate to and interpreted in the light of the New Testament. The Old Testament, like the New Testament, held that life was sacred. In the New Testament, Jesus' answer to capital punishment was to undermine this penalty by demanding that both judges and executioners be sinless. On the occasion when he was asked to rule on a death penalty case, his response was this, you remember it, let him without sin cast the first stone. And I believe that this response was consistent with his other teachings, where he reminded his listeners to beware of condemning others because God's judgments do not necessarily coincide with our own. He constantly reiterated our responsibility to see Christ in our needy neighbor, even to see Christ in our enemies. It is my belief that our Lord, not only by his life, but also by his dying words, Father, forgive them, moved us from the Old Testament perspective of limited retaliation to non-retaliation and active love. In Jesus' teaching, life belongs to God. It is not ours to take. I believe we must repudiate capital punishment because it is incompatible with the basic focus of the gospel, that of reconciliation and redemption. We must give the opportunity for redemption to everyone, and to deprive a person of the possibility of reconciliation to God and to others is the tragedy of capital punishment. For Christians, the ultimate reason for opposing the death penalty must rest on Jesus, our executed Lord. Because of his life and death, all people can be freed of the sinful impulses that have enslaved them. Through his death, we believe all people have become redeemable. And then you remember how our Bibles give three great examples of that. Remember Moses killed a man. God used him greatly. We have David, who saw to the death of Uriah, the husband of Bathsheba. And then, of course, Apostle Paul consenting to the death of Stephen, the first martyr, but also there are other hints that he was raging throughout and killing other people. And yet God used him and it is believed that he was the author of probably 13 books of the New Testament. In turning to Christ, we turn our backs on human idols that have enthralled us in the past, idols that we believe would protect us. We no longer accept our brutal impulses that would seek revenge and repudiate forgiveness. If we are to fully accept the gift of life offered to us by our executed Lord, we can no longer support capital punishment, which is, in the final analysis, a glorification, a worship, an idolization of death. Albert Camus said this: "Let us call capital punishment by the name which, for lack of any other nobility, would at least give the nobility of truth, and let us recognize it for what it essentially is. It is revenge." Execution is a form of violent death, but the penalty of death begins long before the actual execution and includes more persons than the offender. It is part of a cycle of violence which also includes the offender's family, the victim's family, the executioner, the prison warden, the guards, and finally all of us. The death penalty is more than a violent act. It is a violent process that involves all of us, because it is carried out in our name, and no one who is involved in that process can walk away unaffected. In the late 60s, polls in the United States and Canada, and from then on, have shown public support for the death penalty by a majority of more than 2-1. In 1992, 77% of the people polled in this country were in favor of the death penalty. Some people believe that the death penalty is a deterrent to crime. Serious studies have shown that it is not. In fact, the states with the highest rate of homicide allow for the death penalty. It is not a deterrent. We must fully be aware that we resemble John the Baptist, who claimed to be simply a voice crying in the wilderness. And I believe that if we oppose the death penalty, ours is a minority voice. And I haven't quite yet achieved the optimism expressed by Father Joe Nagel in his article entitled "Community for a Dead Man." He says this. He talks about these communities that are now getting involved in opposition to the death penalty, especially the families of victims who do not want the executioner killed, or the execution. These communities serve a great purpose because little by little, their testimonies, more than academic arguments, chip away at the death penalty as an appropriate form of punishment. What possible good is served by such a well-mannered, calculated form of killing, they ask? Their witness and irrefutable logic will eventually bring the United States into line with every other civilized country in the world, which have long since abolished the capital punishment. I have not quite yet achieved that kind of optimism. An ancient Jew once said, "He who saves one life saves the whole world." And I'm committed to saving absolutely every life I can. I realize that ours, who are opposed to capital punishment, is a minority voice. And so I have upon my office door something that Elie Wiesel wrote. It's one of his stories. "One of the just men came to Sodom determined to save its inhabitants from sin, punishment, and indifference. Night and day he walked the streets and markets, preaching against greed and theft, falsehood and indifference, most of all, indifference. In the beginning, people looked at the old prophet and smiled ironically. Then they stopped listening. He no longer even amused them. The killers went on killing. The wise kept silent, as if there were no just man in their midst. One day, a child, moved by compassion for the unfortunate preacher, approached him with these words, "Poor stranger, you shout, you expend yourself, body and soul. Don't you see that it's hopeless?" "Yes, I see," answered the just man. "Then why do you go on?" asked the young child. "I will tell you why. In the beginning, I thought that I could change man. Today, I know I cannot. If I still shout today, if I still scream, if I still go from market to market, from place to place, it is to prevent other people from ultimately changing me. And so I keep on screaming. I'm committed to saving every life I can. I will close my remarks with a poem, a story written by Gerhard Frost, he was my favorite professor at Luther Seminary. It's his poem entitled Diminished. As I understand from his daughter, this poem was written the day after Gary Gilmore was executed in Utah. He died today. They sat him down alone, alone in the cold chair, strapped him to hopelessness and dark despair. 5 men took aim. They couldn't miss and didn't. We grope and fumble for a word and call it justice, but we're not satisfied. Defeat, dead end for all of us. Mocks and shames, convicts, embarrasses, leaves only leaden silence. I look at you, you look at me, we look away. He died today. I am diminished, and all other human beings with me. Have mercy, Lord, on him, on me, on us, the sinners. Now we can stop there and open it up for some discussion. If you want to discuss Dead Man Walking last night, some of you saw it, we sure can do that too. Maybe I'll ask you some questions about it. How many of you did not see it last night? Several of you did not, but maybe you've seen it before. Yeah, okay. Okay, well, for those of you who saw the movie, what are your feelings and reactions? How did the film affect you? Yes, sir.
I thought they had far too many shots of her face pressed up against the bar. I didn't think that was really effective. They never showed his face pressed up against the bar, but they showed her face pressed up against the bar, which limited her perspective of the, you know, facial gestures.
Sure.
That kind of produces mistakes.
Any other comments or questions? Yes, ma'am.
Well, I think it gives us an insight into what the condemned is going through. And I don't know if there's change with all people, you know, in that direction, but there was change with him. It took a long time.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
One of the things that occurs to me in an odd sense is that he was among the most fortunate. As you suggested, no one else seemed to be very healed by that experience at all. But he did, it seemed, experience a reconciliation, restoration, the possibility of everlasting life. through his confrontation with his own death.
Yeah.
As much as it's a horrible thing for a person to face their own death at the hands of the community, the opportunity to know that you're going to die and when, and the very powerful, life-changing possibility that that provides. I mean, many people die suddenly or are killed and don't have that opportunity to contemplate and to take responsibility. And so he had the opportunity to experience transformation with a deadline that was very fixed and certain. So it's kind of both a blessing and a curse to him, but it's kind of a curse to everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you gain any understanding in the victims' families? Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I just felt I admired her strength so through all the things that she had to go with people.
Yeah.
She never, ever wavered in her strength.
Yeah.
And that probably helped her make the decision to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She took his rebuffs.
Yes.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah. My wife, sitting over here, we know Sister Helen. She stayed with us and stayed with us in our home, and she exudes strength. Doesn't seem to be easily flustered. We really admire her for that. Yes.
One of the things that struck me was the biblical debate that was contained in the film between Helen and even the prison chaplain and then some of the prison, that one prison guard.
Yeah.
I think it's symptomatic of what goes on within the church as well, that we can take the same word and, as you in your presentation indicated, read and hear it and then apply it so differently around this issue. And to me, that's where, some, at least within the church, that's where some of the debate really needs to be carried on.
Yes.
It is my understanding that Luther wrote quite an article on government and war and where the government, because Christ okayed what goes to Rome goes to Rome, and what goes to God, but he, didn't Luther say that government, if it is good, that this, whatever falls in line with what goes on in that government is, has been approved by God, but where was Luther's stand on this? Wasn't he for
death? I'm not sure how Luther would stand on death. There's a lot of things about Luther that I find sometimes, as a Lutheran, I have to disagree with.
Also, Luther wasn't well acquainted with democracy.
No, he was not acquainted with
democracy. So we're the government. Yeah. It's not them anymore.
Yeah. So.
Well, that's my point with the coin, you know, given to Caesar what Caesar, given to God what God. Capital punishment is law. That's what it is. It's law, it's not religion. So I sometimes have a real problem with the church and religion, spirituality, getting into capital punishment, because the lawyers and the courts and the attorneys, those are the ones who create the capital punishment law and the ones who execute it. And I don't know, in the state of Washington, what are we, 1% Christians?
Probably.
I mean, we don't have much weight to throw around, do we?
No.
Except that as Christians, we constantly have a responsibility to be speaking truth to government and to be using our faith to influence what happens in public policy and how those laws go.
Yeah.
Well, but what is that truth? Do you know for sure? I don't.
You know, the truth around capital punishment?
Right.
Yeah.
You take the witness of the early church for 300 plus years, the commitment following Christ was not to shed another person's blood, not just another person's innocent blood, but not another person's blood.
Is that Hebrew history?
No, that's Christian.
Christian, yeah.
That's Christian.
Well.
That was changed when Constantine came along. And for me, the witness of those that are closest to Jesus speak to me more about the truth of Jesus' message than what's happened in the last 1700 years since Constantine. that was one of their primary principles and commitments of life, not to shed another person's blood, because Jesus' blood was the final blood that needed to be shed.
We have our oldest granddaughter is now 12, but for a number of years, her comment on this whole thing has been, how are we any better than they are? What we kill, they killed, so what? How are we any better if we turn around and kill them? Are we?
I used to wear around the prison until I received so much static from some of the upper staff. I wore a pink pin that said, why do we kill people who kill people to show people that killing people is wrong? And I was asked finally then to take it off. But, you know, this phrase that we hear so often as justification for, and you heard it in the movie, an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. You know, you hear that. It's from Deuteronomy chapter 19. But the reason it was put in the law was to limit retaliation. Back in those days, I mean, if somebody did something to you, the retaliation was much more than the person deserved. And so an eye for an eye, you don't take more than you are entitled to. And so it was not in the biblical sense, a justification for capital punishment. You're to limit your retaliation. But Hope's in the movie, the girl who was killed, her father said this, Matthew Pancelet is God's mistake. Remember him saying that?
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
God doesn't make mistakes.
So you wouldn't agree. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
God gives man free choice. Yeah. And Matthew, and he took, it was his choice. Yeah. It wasn't God's choice.
But what causes human beings created by God to commit such heinous crimes?
Mental illness.
Yeah, you know, we're so quick to levy punishment without coming over here and looking at the causes of something. In our prison, over 90% of the inmates are there because of some alcohol or drug-related crime. 77% of those in our prison are addicted to alcohol or drugs or both. And any number of these guys will tell you that they have absolutely no recollection of their crime because they were so stoned or so drunk or so strung out on drugs. We had a young man come into our prison 3 years ago, a skinhead. He was a nigger hater, as he proudly said, wore that around him all the time, got into all kinds of fights. Somehow, though, the Spirit of God worked. There was a marvelous transformation in this man, and he became a Christian and never missed worship, never missed Bible study, assumed leadership responsibilities, got out on parole, doing well for 2 years. And then his boss asked him 3 weeks in a row to work 70 hours. And on the third Sunday night, after working 70 hours that week, he said to himself, boy, wouldn't one beer taste good. That one beer led to a six-pack. The next night it was a 12-pack. The next night it was a 12-pack. The next night he went and held up a casino with a water pistol. And he has no recollection of it at all. He had over $700 in his pocket. He said, I had no reason to rob. Why did he do it? And now he'll spend the rest of his life in our prison, because in our state we have three times and you're out. And And, you know, how can we, you know, if we could have had a support team around him somehow, or some way, I don't know, a spiritual mentor, so on. But, yes.
Well, you know, that brings up an issue, as I think most of us, whether we feel that capital punishment is right or wrong, would be uncomfortable with capital punishment, even if we believe that maybe it's the proper solution. And one of the reasons that I think about that is, it's kind of like, where do you choose to begin your idealism? Where do you choose to fight? Do you fight for unborn children? Do you fight wars? Do you fight for the community where violence is bred? Do you provide addiction treatment and say that we got to do that before we start, preserving the people that are addicted and killers? You go to the extreme and you preserve the killers, and you don't provide the addiction services, you don't provide the loving families, you don't provide the community supports, and you don't provide the society that holds life sacred, and you hold it sacred with the murderers at the extreme. And I see that there's value in the example of that as a sentinel, but it's kind of like only treating the canary in the mine and ignoring all of the danger in the mine, and so you keep the canary alive, you get him out into the light, but everybody else is dying inside.
Yeah, it's a tremendously complicated problem. I don't know where we start. When you think of the number of children growing up in our society without any parental leadership, that they, absorb the values of their peers, and I don't know where we start. Yes, sir.
Discussion, and of course, your topic or thing here is, you know, capital punishment, which boils down to, in one sense, the people, or the state is represented by the people against the individual who has committed a crime, who in our process goes through a form of justice that some may argue is not complete and equal for everyone, but it goes through that thing. And then you go to the religious background for why taking that life is, you know, is inappropriate. How do you take it from that scale and elevate it to the reaction against the Holocaust?
Yeah.
Do we allow that to continue with no objection?
Well, if you've read Elie Wiesel's book, A Jew Remembers, entitled, he says that the United States, the Pope, the Britain, were begged to bomb the tracks leading into Auschwitz, but the voices never responded. And Hitler, when knew of all the calls to America, to Britain, to Canada, to bomb the tracks, felt that because there is no response, we must be giving blessing to what he's doing.
I didn't know we knew about that until we got there.
No, America.
We knew all about
America.
It?
Oh yes.
America knew about it. The Pope, Roosevelt knew about it. All of these people, and Hitler. In some of his documents say that because there was no one speaking out against what he was doing, it implied that people were giving blessing to what he was doing.
Well, I guess I'm taking not any type of that type of mass Bosnia, take whatever, you know, any situation you want where it that type of thing going on, and let's say moral persuasion or discussion is not adequate to stop it.
No.
What is the difference where you have that type of thing without the form of a trial? Because usually the trial is conducted by the victor now on our world court or whatever, a UN tribunal. But without any of that type of legal proceeding, in one sense, you proceed against the person that is committing that mass type of crime against humanity. What is the difference between that and the individual crime against humanity by the individual?
Yeah. I don't know how
and
to
how
answer.
How you deal with it.
Yeah, I'm not sure how. Can somebody respond to that?
Well, I was just going to say that it seems to me that there's usually interventions that could have and should have happened much, much earlier, so that it wouldn't have gotten to that point. In the case of Hitler, I mean, if we look at our history, after World War I, it was in part the United States and the other Allied powers that left Germany so deeply indebted, that left people so disillusioned, that allowed somebody like Hitler to come to power. What if we had had a different type of policy toward Germany following World War I? Had Hitler ever been able to get in power? Possibly not. Perhaps then that whole Holocaust would never have happened. In the situation of the things that have happened now recently with the Albanians in Kosovo, certainly there's a history of ethnic conflict and ethnic hatred and retribution back and forth, except that those people had been living together peacefully for quite a few years in recent years. But in the 1980s, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have been calling upon them to make serious economic changes, and perhaps they needed to make some serious economic changes, but the types of changes that we helped to push those institutions toward were so drastic that the economic pain was so great that you had people like Milosevic who could then get into power and play on people's always looking for scapegoats then and play on those racist sympathies as opposed to having perhaps some more measured leader. So it seems to me that we often have a responsibility to make interventions much earlier and not to just ignore those and then let things get to that ultimate.
Now there's an excellent article in the entryway of the dining hall on Kosovo, which really takes a serious look at the mistakes of American foreign policy in that. Yes, sir.
Well,
oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
This look to the future of the split up of Russia, then what is the world, religious world, doing about intervention early in Russia before it explodes even more?
Yeah. Well, and we should have been taking a real close look at that since the 1980s, because economically they are hurting so, so badly. And we're just sitting back and saying, well, whatever happens, happens. It's their problem and whatever. And as things break apart there, I think we're going to see some really horrible things that happen. But we're just saying it's none of our business now. It's going to be our business.
Okay. There was a hand here.
Just a quick question, not to divert the discussion from capital punishment, but about the ALCA's position on abortion and unborn children. Kind of get a perspective on this taking of life. What is the ALCA's position on abortion?
I think here again, it is against abortion. Some of you have read this interesting piece that just came out, that abortion has helped crime, lessen crime in our country. Isn't that great? So, you know, if we don't want to have any more crime, let's be like the Roman ruler and kill all babies. You know, then we're not going to have crime anymore. I mean, it's really kind of an interesting twist on how they see the reduction of crime as due to all the abortions that we've had. Yes, Dick.
Abortion really bothers me, and I've been looking and looking for things, something that would say human life is important. And there just seems to be nothing, you know, at times. the death penalty says it in a very negative way. I think of the dilemma some of the young folks get into. We hear read about young mothers killing their baby at birth. If that mother would have aborted, say, a month or 2 months earlier, everything would have been all right. I mean, we're just sending terrible messages to people.
Yeah.
About the value of human life. I had one other question. Africa has had this amnesty thing going on. Real horror stories. And yet, is that working pretty good? And have you heard anything about that?
Somebody can answer his question? I can't.
Something.
Okay. One of the things that I find interesting is that a lot of those who are in favor of the death penalty are against abortion. It seems kind of inconsistent.
Vice versa.
Yes. Yes, Matt.
Some time ago, many years ago, I was in a study on what is sin. And the Lutheran Church is no longer tied up in the step level of the Catholic Church, where one sin is greater than another, true?
Yeah.
That all sin is sin, whether it's stealing money, quarter, or killing someone.
Right.
God sees it all as sin, so we should look at all activity against God as
right.
sin, and that mm-hmm. there's one crime no greater than another.
Okay. Yeah.
Is that true?
I think so. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
When he brought up the Holocaust, I think Stones from the River was a wonderful book. And we keep talking about the government doing these things. And that book is a wonderful book about how we did it. It was ordinary people. And I lived that because I taught in four prisons in Minnesota. When I walked in the classroom, we had one-third guards, one-third students, and one-third inmates. And as I sat in that chair, I could not tell which was which as I looked around the room. And I never walked out that I didn't stay there, but for the grace of God, go I. I don't think capital punishment changes anything, but I think we do have to do more to sustain a system that prevents people becoming inmates, and also is not sometimes an economic argument. Capital punishment is good because it costs us a lot of money to keep those people in prison all those years.
Well, in our state, to execute a man costs much more than giving him life without parole.
Why?
Because of all the legal fees that are involved.
The Supreme Court ruling.
Yeah. So, well, yes.
Just one comment. Regardless of how you feel on capital punishment, the fact that it's applied unequally, you know, the whiter and richer you are, the less likely you are to have it, should be extremely disturbing.
Well, there are political leaders in our country now who are switching away from a moral argument against the death penalty to the idea that we are executing too many innocent people. This book here, Convicted by Juries, Exonerated by Science, we'll say something about that, but the argument against the death penalty has moved away from the morality issue to the fact that we have been executing too many innocent people. And we've had, you know, several examples lately where just by the last minute some DNA evidence has proven that the guy was innocent. We're going to see a movie toward a video at the end here now, but I want to share one story with you about Charles Rhines, who is in our prison. He is convicted of murder and is due to die. As soon as he came into prison, about a couple of weeks after he got there, he sent me a note saying, I have never been confirmed. I would like to, and I'm a Lutheran, and I would like to take confirmation instruction, which I offered him. It was an 8-week course. And on the day of his confirmation, I had our bishop
come into the church, to the prison. Got special permission. We went down to his cell, to death row, and there the bishop confirmed him and also offered him the Lord's Supper. I have counted the steps from that particular cell up to my office, and someday if Charles is executed and I have to accompany him, I will write a book about 1,384 steps will be this title. But he was moved. We built, South Dakota built another prison just about half a block away, supposedly much more secure, and Charles was placed there, and I went over to see him shortly after he got there, and they took us into what was the weight room. And here came Charles in an orange jumpsuit, chains between his legs. We're ready to show the video. And chain around his waist with his handcuffs here, and then a chain from here around down to here. And he came in very, very difficult for him to walk, and he sat down. I had set up the private communion on a weight bench, and I saw all of this. The whole room was surrounded with guards. I don't know what they expected to have happen, but the whole situation, I asked Charles, how in the world do you make it from day to day? And with extreme effort, Charles reached over here like this and picked up the little wafer, and he says, "This is how I make it." And someday, I suspect that South Dakota will execute Charles. I wonder why this man has made a remarkable change in his life. Not a, death row thing, but something that I feel is very, very genuine. We'll close with a video which shows an alternative to the death penalty. People are saying, instead of vengeance, they're saying, giving another message.
Is a two-week educational tour of 15 Midwestern cities in June. aimed at promoting the message that many murder victims' families have chosen a path of reconciliation and healing rather than vengeance, and have come to oppose the death penalty in any form. The message is similar to that which has been preached in the past at rallies in Washington, D.C., at events such as the Texans Against State Killing March in 1991, and other organized campaigns. But it's the first large-scale effort by a group of people who speak from first-hand experience as ones who have lost a relative to murder. Marietta lost her daughter, Bill his grandmother. Pat lost her uncle, Joe Marva, her brother. Marie lost her mother-in-law, Sam, his mother. Judy, her grandmother. Inez, her son. They gather for support and to find ways to strive for healing and reconciliation instead of vengeance.
It's not like we're advocating forgiving the offender and then putting them back out on the street again to hurt other people. You know, their society does have a right to protect you and from people who do violent things. But there are other ways to accomplish that than by executing them. And those are the ways that we need to explore and develop.
I know I've found out a lot of people that are in favor of the death penalty, and some of the arguments that they use, it seems like they can't win on any other argument. They say, well, what about if it happened to somebody in your family? What happened if it was your parent or your child or your brother or your sister? Wouldn't you want that person to get the death penalty in that case? The message that we have, if we say no, we don't want the life taken for the loss of our loved one, then it's something that they really don't have an answer for that. I've been on some different radio talk shows and things like that, and where the disc jockey is totally in favor of the death penalty. But the question he'll ask somebody else to fight the death penalty, when he talks about the family, that person sits there and says, well, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, the way my family's ever been killed, and I'm not sure it's exactly how I would feel. You're kind of at a loss for the answer of taking another life. And we found it out that the message we have and the answer we have is very, very powerful.
No amount of justice going to bring my son back. I said, killing those guys is just, it's just not going to bring my son back either. They could kill 10,000 people. It's not going to heal my heart for the hurt that I felt for my son. So it's no use in it. No use in it at all. I don't see why they should die. You know, there's three people dead already. Why should they kill five more? That'd be eight. Eight lives just for nothing.
With more families grieving,
some more hearts going to be hurt, you know? And then they're going to be in the same situation really.
I know that I've seen lots of parents who retain a vindictive mindset. And I see that in a real way, the offender gets another victim because the quality of life of the person who retains a vindictive mindset is really diminished. You know, they're tormented, they're filled with hatred, they're bitter, they're unhappy people. And it just isn't healthy. And even those people who've gotten the opportunity to see that the offender who caused them such pain, got a chance to see them executed, when it's over and done with, they're left just as empty and unsatisfied and unhealed as they were to begin with.
We look at the justice system, they do a lot to try to keep you agitated, and as the victim's families, they try to keep you agitated and keep you thinking, yes, vengeance, 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 because that looks good on the 6 o'clock news. Mm-hmm. And as I look at the sanctity of life, it all seems to roll around and come back to a whole story of redemption. And those people who take a life deserve to be redeemed.
The message of murder victims' families for reconciliation runs against the grain of much of American society, a society where retaliation is considered acceptable and vengeance seen as normal.
When we spoke out against the death penalty, when my family spoke out against the death penalty, that there was a kind of reaction that nobody ever expects, I think, when this happens to them, and that is,
you are either a saint or you're an emotional freak. And nobody wants to touch you or come near you or have anything to do with you because they just don't understand what you're doing or what you're saying. And we felt really isolated.
But ultimately, the proponents will say, but it's a matter of justice for the victim's family. And that's where we, you know, have a unique perspective and can say, but it is not justice. There are no amount of retaliatory deaths that will compensate to us the loss of our loved ones or restore them to our arms. And to say that the death of even one person is going to be just retribution is an insult to the immeasurable worth of the people that we love. You just can't put that kind of a value on the life of someone that we love. Yeah. So we can say that with authority and with credibility the way no one else can.
Yeah.
And so it's a very important voice to be brought to the arena of opposition against the death penalty.
During the MVFR meetings, there are opportunities to share feelings and questions.
I really struggled with, would I be betraying my little girl by being willing to forgive someone who did such terrible things to her both before she died and after she died? And I really struggled with that. I mean, that's valid.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really glad that God was persistent with me and kept calling me beyond that.
There's got to be a place for the victims' families who don't want to be exploited, who don't want to live their lives in this hatred and this sense of vengeance and hang on to it for 10 years until somebody's killed and then think they're going to feel better and then find out that they don't. They only feel worse. All the studies show that even those murder victims' families who thought they were for the death penalty, as time went on, they began to be sorry that they were part of that cycle of violence.
But I know I got support. You know, I know there's people here that can understand what I'm talking about, you know. So it's not a time when a person's murdered. It's the time we get together. We can't bring him back 3 months ago. I can't bring my brother back. She can't bring our daughter back. But we all here with each other. So I thank God for the group.
I know the pain that a person goes through. And I know what helped me. Mm-hmm. And so when I see that Maxie is in pain, I know that somewhere I've got an answer for her, and just to try to share that with her, because I know that God brought me a peace, and God can bring her that peace, and I see God giving her peace.
That's been a great deal to me to personally know people who have had similar experiences in terms of suffering in relation to violence in our society.
One key element in dealing with this issue is the idea of reconciliation, something that MVFR members arrive at in different ways and at different times.